The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And by Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
And by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community, Dartmouth Hitchcock is here, dartmouth-hitchcock.org.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Dan Brown, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Dan Brown has sold more than 200 million copies of his books since The Da Vinci Code hit in 2003. Three of his novels have been made into films starring Tom Hanks as fictional Harvard professor Robert Langdon.
Dante defined our modern conception of hell 700 years ago.
But these circles of hell have been rearranged.
His newest, Origin, pits the theories of a bold tech billionaire and avowed atheist against creationism. Like its predecessors, Origin thrusts Langdon into a breathless 24-hour scavenger hunt for keys, codes, and symbols in spectacular European locations, again accompanied by a brilliant and beautiful woman. Brown says Origin was inspired in part by a piece of music.
I've always been fascinated with mixing the very old and the very new. And several years ago, I heard a piece of music called the Charles Darwin Mass, which took the very old structure of a Christian mass and mixed in the very modern words of Charles Darwin. And this really inspired me to want to write Origin. And the piece of music, by coincidence, happened to be written by a professional composer who is my brother.
That composer, Gregory Brown, joined us at the Music Hall along with the family patriarch, Dick Brown. Dick introduced a short film tracking his famous son's extensive research at dazzling sites throughout Spain, where Origin is set. Then Dan Brown stepped out on stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth in front of a sold-out crowd to talk about the ethical dilemma that drove this novel's plot.
This new novel, Origin, deals very directly with this ongoing battle between science and religion. And the story begins with a brilliant futurist who has made a discovery that he believes will undermine the foundations of world religion. And our hero, Robert Langdon, because he has terribly bad luck and is always in the wrong place at the wrong time, gets pulled into this mystery and finds himself on a jaunt across Spain, grappling with what he believes is one of the most thought-provoking questions of our time. Will God survive science? And in the novel, Langdon makes the point that historically, gods have not survived science. The ancient god Thor, for example, we once believed was responsible for throwing lightning bolts, but eventually science discovered that lightning was caused by static electricity, and Thor was banished as a myth of a bygone era. Throughout history, our gods have always changed. Just like our species, our religions have evolved, and they continue to do so. Early Christian doctrine insisted that God had placed mankind at the center of the universe. But Copernicus and Galileo proved that God had not only placed mankind at the center of the universe, or he had not placed them at the center of the universe, he had also not placed them at the center of our own solar system. And today, that revised scientific model of the universe is unanimously accepted, even by the deeply devout. Religious doctrine has had to adjust its teachings in the face of increased scientific knowledge. A similar thing happened to the biblical account of Adam and Eve, who, if we read scripture literally, were divinely created as two fully formed human beings, who then procreated and spawned the entire human race, including all of the different ethnicities, with none of the genetic problems caused by inbreeding. Now, today, that literal story of Adam and Eve for many people does not stand up in the face of evolutionary science. We can read Genesis, we can read this story of Adam and Eve as a beautiful morality tale, as an important piece of our quest to understand where we came from. But science makes it very difficult to believe in the literal story of Adam and Eve, even if we desperately want to. And nowadays, with the exception of the big existential questions, science, rather than religion, is the lens through which we see our world. So if we look at this historical trend of science eating away at the claims of religion, we have to wonder if the same process of demystification and de-religionization will continue into the future. We have to wonder what happens if someday a biologist employs advances in genetics and biochemistry to create a concoction in a petri dish from which suddenly springs life. Very abruptly, that Sistine Chapel image of God reaching down to infuse mankind with life starts to look a bit like the ancient Roman drawing of Minerva springing from the head of Jupiter, a notion that we now find antiquated and obsolete. And as we study evolution, what does it do to our spiritual sense of our place in the cosmos when we realize that our species is a work in progress, that all of us, each one of us in this room, is just like the Neanderthal man or the lungfish, nothing but a passing phase on an evolutionary scale, a fleeting grace note on the scale of time. Now, for most of us, there is one existential question that inspires even the most skeptical to open the door to God, even if just a little bit. And that question is, what happens when we die? Now, science suggests that in death, all of our hopes and dreams and memories simply disintegrate and disappear into the ether. Now, this makes rational sense because your brain is essentially just a machine whose electrical power line has just been cut. But religions, all religions, promise that there is indeed something beyond that moment of death, and how we all long to believe that, especially those of us who have lost people that are close to us. Now, at some point in the future, medical science may well develop a way to enable human beings to die temporarily and to stay dead long enough that when we return, we have useful knowledge of the afterlife, or heaven forbid, its total non-existence. But if there is an afterlife, will Christians and Muslims and Hindus and atheists all have different death experiences? And if not, if they all have identical death experiences, what does that say about the unique claims of each religion regarding the afterlife? Now, scientific progress historically has not been helpful to religion, but make no mistake about it, religion has been no friend to science either. In the 8th century, the greatest learning center on earth was the city of Baghdad, a city that welcomed all religions, philosophies, and sciences to its universities. And for 500 years, the outpouring of scientific enlightenment and innovation from Baghdad was like nothing the world had ever seen. And we still use their scientific inventions today, and we still call them by their Arabic names: algebra, algorithms, alchemy, chemistry, ciphers, and my dad's personal favorite, the number zero. In the 11th century, a religious scholar named Hamid al-Ghazali wrote a series of persuasive texts declaring that mathematics was the philosophy of the devil, and he urged that scientific study be replaced by theological study. And almost overnight, scientific investigation was replaced by religious revelation, and that entire scientific movement in Baghdad collapsed. Christian clerics mounted similar religious attacks on science directed at Bruno, Galileo, and Copernicus, either burning, imprisoning, or discrediting some of science's most brilliant minds and ideas. And it is still happening today. Recently in Madrid, the World Federation of Catholic Medical Associations declared they were taking out a war on genetic medicine. They proclaimed that science lacks soul and therefore needs to be restrained by the church. And on a personal note, my mother, who recently passed away, was given 10 extra years, fantastically healthy extra years, thanks to genetic medicine. So a war on genetic medicine it's very personal to me. In this country, there are science teachers attempting to teach evolution who are besieged and physically threatened by angry parents demanding equal billing for creationism and Adam and Eve. And I wouldn't say this in Texas, but I find it absolutely mind-boggling that in the year 2017, we have politicians who will openly declare that the Earth is 6,000 years old and that the fossil record was put there to test our faith. And what makes it even worse is that because this view of the world is classified as a religious idea, not only are we forbidden to ridicule it, we are actually debating whether or not to teach it to our students in school. Now, every one of us in this room, regardless of our particular religious beliefs or even lack thereof, has experienced one of those private moments when we stare up into a starlit sky and we perceive the divine. We may not have a word for it, but we know that whatever's up there is bigger than we are. It is beyond our intellectual grasp. And at that moment, our specific faith is totally irrelevant. Whether we're staring up at the stars, or holding a newborn child, or falling in love, or quietly fearing our own mortality, these are universal experiences shared across cultures. So here's the question. If we all have spiritual experiences that are so similar, why are our religions all so different? And the answer is they are not. The perceived differences between religions arise when we start using language, when we start trying to quantify, record, and share our experiences, when we attempt to classify a concrete architecture, when we start interpreting our metaphors as literal fact. And we each have a moral compass inside of us, and whether that compass is guided by faith, philosophy, family, friends, or some combination of all of them, that compass functions on a few fundamental truths that are inscribed in our psyches, truths that we understand viscerally, regardless of where we live, what language we speak, or what our religious beliefs might be. And these truths are quite simply, kindness is better than cruelty, creating is better than destroying, and love is better than hate. I had an absolutely amazing time researching this book. It was a real adventure. That adventure began at the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, one of the world's great museums of modern and contemporary art. And in origin, I thought it would be fun to throw Langdon into this world of modern art. He's a classicist, understands Renaissance art, but I thought I'd throw him into the world of modern art and kind of watch him flounder a bit, as many of us do in museums of modern art. And I don't know how many of you have had this experience, but I've had it. I've walked into a well-known museum, walked into a gallery, and there in the center of this gallery, underneath a spotlight, is a wheelbarrow filled with Jell-O. And you look at this thing, and you look at it a little bit longer, and then you say, am I on candid camera? And then you read the description, the guide, and you realize you're not on candid camera. This is a masterpiece that critics have hailed as a fiendish denunciation of materialism, and it's worth $2.6 million. So, and you think, wow, I am in the wrong business. Like many, I'd felt that contemporary art kind of escaped me on some level, and I thought Origin is going to be my chance, my excuse to travel the world, talk to curators in museums of contemporary art, and really learn and figure out what it is that I've been missing. And so my research began at the Guggenheim in Bilbao, where I was very fortunate to spend a lot of time with the lead curator there. He was a very nice man. As we toured the museum, I was very open with him about my lack of experience with contemporary art and my sincere desire to understand it. And as we toured the gallery, we came first upon a room of naked mannequins all wearing red bandanas. Okay. I saw a canoe made of chicken wire fencing, which clearly wouldn't float in case you missed the irony there. And a 30-minute video of an old man sleeping. I was doing the best I could on this tour until we came to a gallery where there was this massive white canvas, just enormous. It was all white except for a tiny blob of red in the lower left-hand corner. And I looked at this curator and I said, I could have done that. And he smiled and he looked back at me and he said, but you didn't. And that was kind of the moment that I began to understand this notion of concept art. An idea in much of contemporary art The idea is much more important than the artifact itself. In other words, even if you possess the technical skill to create this same object, you didn't have the idea. And this was really helpful as I began to view the collection through this new lens. I started to feel more confident and open-minded. I started looking at these pieces as interesting ideas rather than skillfully rendered objects of art. And toward the end of the tour, we entered this gallery where there was this white fabric that was stretched across the floor, stretched really taut, a piece of sailcloth. And I was now feeling newly enlightened. I said, that's really beautiful. What is that? He said, oh, that's just a light well. The light was coming in and ruining the stuff below. That's not even a piece of art. And I just, I give up. Apparently, I still had some things to learn about modern art. I'm going to finish here in just a minute, but I wanted to take just a second to talk a little bit more about artificial intelligence because it is fascinating, it is here, and it is going to change everything. While researching Origin, I spent a lot of time talking to futurists and AI scientists. Many of them were optimistic about the future of mankind. Some of them believe that we are on the dawn of a new renaissance and that AI will help us solve some big global problems, things like overpopulation, scarcity, pollution. Other futurists fear that AI is so powerful that it will eventually bring an end to humanity. And as evidence, they point out that the human species has never created a technology that we have not weaponized. The only thing that all futurists can agree on is that the future is coming much, much faster than we think. Every new technology we invent becomes a tool to create new technology. And so we get this wild acceleration and this exponential graph of technological progress. The real question facing us now is whether, as our technologies race forward, our philosophies can keep pace, whether our ethics will expand rapidly enough that we can responsibly wield the dazzling tools that we are now creating. And so with that in mind, I'd like to close tonight by making a plea that I've made many times before, including, I believe, from this very stage. As we move forward and grapple with the ethical dilemmas of the future, our various spiritualities will, of course, play an influential role in our decision-making. They always have. I just hope that we can remember that there is nothing in our DNA that predetermines our beliefs. And now, more than ever, there is enormous danger in believing we are infallible, that our version of the truth is absolute, and that those who do not think like we do are enemies. It is critical that we live with open minds, that we educate ourselves, that we ask difficult questions, and above all, that we engage in dialogue. And so in the name of dialogue and sharing ideas, I would just like to acknowledge that what has brought us together tonight in this room is quite simply books, those magical artifacts that create dialogue and share ideas across borders, across cultures, across languages, and most importantly, across time. So for all of you in the audience who treasure books and who read books, I thank you very much.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Dan Brown, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Dan Brown's immensely popular novels and the movies based on them have been condemned as insulting and inaccurate by the Catholic Church. His work has also inspired college courses, legions of European tours, and, Brown hopes, a spirited dialogue about science and religion. Brown dedicates Origins to his parents for encouraging his curiosity and discussing the big questions. His father, Dick, taught mathematics and planted envelopes with codes under the Christmas tree that led his three kids to find their presents. His mother, Connie, was a church organist who died just months before Origins was released. When we sat down together on stage at the Music Hall, I asked Dan Brown what kind of discussions they had around the Brown family dinner table.
I didn't realize until much later how unique my upbringing was. I do remember we didn't have a television. That was very upsetting to me because I'd go to school and people would be talking about the Love Boat and I just have No idea what it was. By the way, Fred Grandy, Gopher on the Love Boat, was one of my first babysitters, just so you know. He went to Phillips Exeter. Yeah, so how's that for a non-sequitur? What was your question? Oh,
Julie, did you know Julie?
I didn't. I had a crush on Julie. It's an amazing thing what happens when you encourage children to read. Not only is there an enormous amount of learning, far more important than that, kids learn that learning is fun. And the way it influenced me most directly is that I enjoy learning, and so therefore I enjoy writing books where people can learn. And clearly these books are thrillers, they're supposed to be fun, but ideally when you're done you feel like you've gained something, you've learned something about the world around you.
In this case, we learn about the history of Spain and Franco's reign. We learned so much about art and architecture in La Sagrada Familia. So, when you're writing this, are you thinking, okay, let's shove some vegetables in here? I mean, like, how do you limit that?
You know what? I mean, that is a lot of the work I do. The nuts and bolts of what I do is trying to figure out what is the titration? What is the mix of plot or emotion or facts or description such that ideally the pages will turn themselves and you will never sort of hit a section where you think, okay, enough, I want to get on to the next thing. Ideally, if I've done my job well, I anticipate that and get you to the next bit as quickly as possible.
Were you a religious kid?
I was. I grew up very religious. I grew up, you know, my mom was the choir director and the church organist. Learned how to read music sitting on the piano bench next to her, turning pages. And so I heard quite a bit of church. I actually went to a church camp in the summer. I read the Bible. And it was kind of interesting because I didn't really realize that there was a problem with science and religion until I went to the Boston Museum of Science and saw this exhibit on evolution. And I'd heard about Adam and Eve. And I went to a visiting priest at the time, and I said, hey, which story is true? And unfortunately, he said, nice boys don't ask that question. And that really messed me up, and I've been struggling ever since. That's right.
Well, you spoke earlier about wanting to create a dialogue between, you know, in some cases, creationists, and for lack of a better word, evolutionists, faith and fact, right? But, you know, it was revealed to you that there was a discrepancy. And in the book, there's this idea, Edmund Kirsch, this character, thinks that he's going to reveal the truth and people are going to understand. But you also said that congressmen are talking about the Earth being 6,000 years old. So is revelation, is discovery, is that enough?
I don't think so. I think that we have to continually delve deeper and use all the tools at our disposal to learn. And, you know, it's funny, people say, are you anti-religious? And I'm not at all, actually. I will happily admit that religion does an enormous amount of good in the world and creates support systems. And, it's a funny thing because as a child, I remember being very, very comforted by religion. And there was this moment when a lot of that changed very suddenly for me. One of my classmates died of leukemia at 11 years old. We were both 11 years old, and she died, and I remember the service, and the priest said, it's okay, this is all part of God's plan. And while I could understand how that was comforting to some people, for some reason I reacted the opposite. And I thought, well, I hate this plan. This is a terrible plan. And I don't like a God who would have this plan. And that really set me off in a much different direction. But the funny thing is, the farther you go into the world of science, the deeper you go, the more you realize the questions start coming back, and they are spiritual in nature. And my mom had a great way of putting it. She told me once that science and religion are just two different languages attempting to tell the same story, and that's the way I remember her.
And Robert Langdon says that
as well. Of
course,
Robert Langdon plagiarizes from my mom all the time.
Well, it was on this stage, I was speaking to Krista Tippett last spring, and she said something very similar, you know, that scientists and cosmologists and physicists now occupy the place that religious leaders used to occupy in helping us interpret or imagine our place in the universe. So what does understanding these two languages add? You know, how does it change our understanding of science to know about what the religious people believe or what religious people believe about science?
I believe that the dialogue needs to deepen, and both sides need to give a little bit. You know, highly rational people need to be able to admit that religion serves an enormously important purpose and function in the lives of a lot of highly intellectually smart people, and that just because you're religious does not mean that you have sacrificed your intellect. And the thing that religious people need to understand, especially at the fundamental level, is that religion does not have the market cornered on morality. There are a billion atheists on the planet now, and a lot of them are very generous, altruistic, compassionate people. You know, if both sides can admit that, we might start getting somewhere.
Right. Well, the new atheist, you know, the Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, there's this kind of absolutism. And I wonder, in the same way that religious fervor can be dangerous, is there a danger to that?
Of course there is. Yeah. Of course there is. If we get too strident. I think a lot of those people, they are reactionary against this idea of taking scripture and reading it as literal fact. But as far as some of the bigger ideas of religion, I think they're probably pretty tolerant.
Hmm. Similarly, there are acts of extreme violence in this book that are motivated by the belief that a way of life is being threatened by other people, right? And this is the basis of terrorism, the motivation for it. So, you know, looking at world through a purely religious lens, where does that lead people? Where can that lead people?
Well, I actually personally don't think terrorism has anything to do with religion. I think religion is often held up as a banner, as a call to action, because religion inspires people. But, you know, it's funny. I was talking to a scientist about the future of AI and how it's going to change the world. We're going to have a new renaissance, and there's going to be a lot more abundance. And this particular woman felt that abundance was going to really help the problem of terrorism, because terrorism springs from scarcity, springs from not being heard, not being able to provide for your family, and being so frustrated that the only way you can get listened to is to lash out. And unfortunately, you know, religion, you know, since the beginning of history, has been used as a call to arms. And one of the reasons I wrote this book in Spain, because it's the home of the Inquisition. And certainly, you know, we think of terrorism as a problem, you know, as a Muslim issue, and it's, you know, historically it's a world issue.
Hmm. Want to back up for a second and ask a listener question, because you talked about when you were a child being religious and that changing. What do you think will happen to you when you die?
Wow, we were having such a nice evening. You know what? I'm happy to say I have no idea. If I had to take a bet, I'd bet that it's like falling asleep and you just don't wake up. But that's a scary thing to think of, and I really hope I'm wrong. And and I'm happy to. I will happily say maybe I'm wrong, and I guess we're all going to find out. So, see you there. Actually, I probably won't. I have a feeling I'm going somewhere else. That's right.
A number of people have asked about your research, and you talked about your research. We saw a little bit of it in your film. But asking specifically about technological research. Now, there is a fantastic AI character in this book, Siri on steroids, I think Langdon calls him. Feels guilt in a way. There's a sense of humor. And I wonder how much of that is factual. How far along are we in that creation?
It really depends who you talk to. It's interesting, you know, the thing about AI is that it's only powerful if it knows how to learn. And that's what this deep learning is, what's making artificial intelligence so powerful. And the thing that's changed so dramatically in the world just in the last 10 years is that our entire history is digitized and accessible. So AI could read every book, see every TV show, see every movie, and learn human behavior and learn human motivation. Very, very quickly. And so what's happening is that you're getting these AI entities that are quite human. And the Turing test, you know, was passed quite some time ago. I mean, it has been a while now that we've had artificial intelligence machines that you just can't tell the difference. Clearly we don't have robots that look very human, but we have interfaces that will make you think you're talking to a human.
I'm Virginia Prescott talking with Dan Brown about his new book, Origin. The conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Okay, so a number of people are also asking about your locations. One in particular, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, right? When you give it that kind of attention, this man who sold 200 million books and now suddenly the Mona Lisa is popular at the Louvre again.
I think it was pretty popular before I came along, as I recall. I'm not going to take any credit for that one.
I don't know. They might even disagree with you. But let's say Rosslyn Chapel in Scotland, you know, is overrun with tourists now. So what are you giving these museums when you do this?
I don't really think of that. I mean, a place like the Guggenheim doesn't need me. They are a spectacularly popular location with or without these books. I mean, I know we've already spoken, they've experienced an uptick. But what I really hope, as far as modern art, is that this book inspires a whole lot of people to take it seriously and dive into it. And something has happened to me in the last few years with respect to modern art. I've become an enormous fan, and I would now rather go to MoMA than the National Gallery. I just think that it is more challenging, and you can go to the Grand Gallery of the Louvre, and you can walk down the hallway, and every single painting is meticulously crafted, and you can appreciate the brushstrokes and the skill that goes into every one of these paintings. You may have favorites or may not care for some, but clearly whoever made them had some serious skill. You go to a museum of modern art, and a lot of the time you're challenged to even know why it's art. And that sounds kind of disrespectful, but I think we've all had that experience where we're just like, are you kidding me? You know, that's a rubber duck sitting on top of a hamburger. Like, who cares? It doesn't make any sense. And so I have started to find the conversations I have about modern art to be really, really interesting. And if you have a chance ever to go to the Guggenheim, you should absolutely go. The building itself is simply spectacular. It has, I think, 30,000 titanium tiles. And I describe it as this like Leviathan that looks like it's come out of the Nervion River and it's just lying there. As you walk around it, the sunlight catches it differently with every step, and it mutates with every step. It's absolutely beautiful.
Dan Brown on one of the settings from his most recent book, Origin. A note here that shortly after we spoke, a painting of Jesus Christ by Leonardo da Vinci sold for a record-breaking $450 million. An astounding price that some art critics speculate could be evidence of the Dan Brown effect. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Dan Brown, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. His newest novel, Origin, is set in Spain, mostly in Barcelona, home of the architect Antoni Gaudí. His Art Nouveau-inspired apartment buildings, parks, and the still incomplete Cathedral of La Sagrada Familia are settings for the conflict between the natural world and the divine that play out in the novel. I asked Dan Brown what drew him to the work of Gaudí.
You know, I was writing a novel that had to do with a return to I don't want to ruin the ending, but this idea that religions at their core are organic. If you look at there's this beautiful diagram in this in a library in the Netherlands. It's called the River of Thought, and it starts out with the early humans who just worship nature. They basically walked outside, looked at the stars, looked at the trees, and said, "Wow, that is amazing." And over time, this timeline splits. It's a river that splits into various tributaries, and different religions come in. And by the end, we have hundreds of different religions. And the thing I love about Gaudí is that he essentially shows a reverence for all that is organic. And his work is very, very naturally inspired. You can't look at the church Sagrada Familia without thinking of it looks like it just sort of grew out of the cement. There are literally giant lizards and snails crawling up the outside of this building. It's kind of funny because I knew I was going to include Sagrada Familia in this novel, and I had the novel all outlined. And I was back in Spain while I was writing the novel, and I went to the church and stumbled across this incredible staircase, this unbelievable spiral staircase that was absolutely terrifying, very, very dangerous. And halfway up, I thought, somebody has got to die in here. and I had to go back and change the outline to make sure somebody died in Sagrada Familia. So that's might be the tail wagging the dog a little bit, but that's how it works sometimes.
Well, that's bringing up some other great questions from listeners about your research. What was the most surprising piece of information you came across that changed the original plot line? And there's a similar question here. How often does your main plot line change after you do your research?
Sure. Well, there for anyone who's read the book, there is a location at the very end of the book that when I heard about it, I thought, this place can't possibly exist. It is too perfect. I mean, it's almost like I hired somebody to build it for this book. And I thought, this place can't exist. So I flew to Spain, and sure enough, it exists. And I stood in this space. It is a perfect fusion of science and religion. And the fact that it existed entirely changed the ending of this book, where the ending was set. I said, I've got to set the ending there.
Other question here about locations. Would you ever consider writing a Robert Langdon novel that takes place in New England? Maine?
Wow. The Maine Masterpiece is my next novel. No, really. I suppose I could. I mean, we have these amazing secret societies here. We have a lot of Ivy League schools. Probably not.
Well, people do read your books. They go to these places. They believe that you're providing clues about secret societies and, clandestine brotherhoods pulling the levers, shadowy fringe figures. They do want to believe, right? They love to solve these mysteries. And you've talked a lot about belief. What is the human predilection for belief that your books are feeding?
Yeah, there's a character in this novel, Edmund Kirsch, who gives a presentation. He talks about this very thing. He talks about how the human mind has an operating system that's four words, and it is despise chaos, seek order. The human mind despises chaos, and it is one of the reasons we are comforted when we're told that a tragedy is part of God's plan. We hate to think that life is random and that something terrible has happened. We want to know that somebody's in control. And strangely, that's really the same place that conspiracy theory comes from. When we look at a bunch of different events, it's hard for our minds to believe that they're random, and we create these data constellations that kind of link everything. And that is just the way we are wired. We like it's why when we walk past paintings that are crooked, we straighten them. We can't stand chaos. At least I do. You guys do that too, don't you? That's right.
But it is interesting that our brains are wired to pick out patterns. We want to predict things. But a thriller upsets all of that. You are taking that predictive model and then throwing it on its end. So how do you do that?
It's part of a game. It's what we all love, that aha moment. It's why we do crossword puzzles. You love to figure something out. And my job as a thriller writer is to withhold as much as I possibly can. I'll take a timeline, that a chronology of events, and tell it to you out of order, or tell it to you through points of view where you don't get all the information. And ideally, you want to keep turning pages to have that aha moment, say, oh, that's who killed the guy, or whoever, that's who wrote this code.
You were talking earlier about sparking a dialogue. How do you do it in your own life? How do you do it with your own friends and have those discussions?
This will sound trite, but I do think it's about passion. It's about actually caring. And it's about caring enough to hear the point of view of someone who disagrees with you wholeheartedly, and respecting that idea and giving people a chance to change your mind. And my mind has been changed on many, many things. And there is nothing more exciting than hearing a point of view and feeling enlightened and having your horizons expanded.
Where do we do it? That's the question.
Right here. I mean, it's funny. People have asked me if I believe in God and what my religious experiences are like. And I will tell you that I strongly believe that, at least in my life, I sense the divine in moments that groups of people are together sharing ideas. And we all have something to offer. We all have different life experiences and different points of view. And when we open up and are not fearful, and we share
our truth, whatever it is, without fear of being judged, we change the world and we change people's minds and we let them change ours.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and you're listening to Writers on a New England Stage with Dan Brown, recorded live at the Historic Theater at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. What other genres do you read that influence your writing that may not necessarily be connected to religion or science?
I read a lot of Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, absolutely. Just the archetype of the myth. The stories have not changed. We tell them differently. But, you know, storytelling is the oldest art form on earth. We used to stand around fires and tell stories. That just hasn't changed at all. We have new ways of doing it. People are worried about technology taking the book away. It's not. It's just offering new ways to share stories. I'm not worried about it at all.
But you were raised in a house without television, and now so many people, digital natives, second generation digital natives, are got a screen in front of them all the time. Now, what kind of advice would you give
to
them?
Well, it's interesting because there's a moment in the book when somebody where a priest notes that if you look at the youth of today, they're looking down and not up. It's true. We're all looking down. And the amazing thing that's happened is we used to have moments of personal time for reflection. You're sitting in a doctor's office. You have 10 minutes, and you just sit there, and you think, and you're quiet. And now we don't do that. We pull out you pull out your cell phone instantly and check your mail and see what's happening. And I think if I had children who were doing that, I would, on some level, require some sort of time for personal reflection. But, you know, technology is here to stay, and it's connecting us in a bunch of really exciting ways. You just have to have a little of both, and there's a very addictive quality to it.
Are you able to read a book yourself and turn off your writer's brain and enjoy the book, or do you analyze the book as a writer?
I can't turn it off. It's awful. You know, this is one of the reasons I read so much nonfiction. But I'm almost incapable of reading a book without a highlighter in my hand because I might learn something that I can share or that I can put in a novel. But in some ways, it's a blessing because I read much more carefully and I read with a lot more respect for how hard it is to put together a book.
How do you organize all that information?
Well, anybody who's seen my office, I did have somebody walk in and say, "Oh my God, I'm glad I know you because I would think a serial killer lives here." There's a lot of strange old books with sticky notes. There's a lot of, you know, lines of yarn connecting different things on the wall and, you know, symbols scrawled in blood. No, not quite that bad. It's an ordered chaos. And one of the reasons I write every day is because I have a terrible memory. And if I take a few days off, I go back and I have no idea what any of it means.
Do you begin to look at the world through Robert Langdon's eyes?
Always, yeah. I mean, certainly when I'm writing and I go to Spain, I'm knowing that I'm going to be describing these places through Langdon's eyes. And so I try to see through his eyes. And he's essentially the guy I wish I could be. He's braver, smarter, he has a much cooler life. And it's funny, I had a woman once, I mentioned that Langdon was much smarter than I am, and she said, "Well, everything that he says you have to think of." And I had to explain that when Langdon just off the cuff says, "Let me tell you about this painting," that took me 3 days to research and write, so.
This may be my favorite question. Where's my pie plate?
Peter Clark's here? It's coming. It's a small community here, isn't it? Where's my pie plate? You know, it's coming. Peter and Jennifer, I've got your pie plate. It's safe. My apologies, I've had it entirely too long. It will be on your desk tomorrow. Now that you have shamed me publicly.
Well, in this battle that has been going on for a really long time between religion and science, can they coexist? And are we heading in the right direction or not?
You know, it's funny. If you look at data. We are moving in a secular direction. There's a strange thing that happens. The older a culture is, the more secular it becomes. Europe is becoming much, much more secular. It's an older society than the U.S. The U.S. has just passed through a very fundamentalist period where I guess we're still sort of in it on some level, but we are actually moving in a secular level. And the regions of the world that are becoming deeply religious the fastest is Africa. And so as cultures progress and become more technologically enabled and become older, we move in a secular way. And the thinking is that this planet is moving in our species is moving in a secular direction, and we'll see what happens. I do think that in addition to being wired for order, we are wired for some sort of spirituality, that we do perceive the divine, even if we try to resist it. It is there. It is there in the simplest word. It's there in love, and we sense that when we feel love, we sense that it's not of this realm.
Well, you're talking about data and the direction we're moving, but how about what do you feel or maybe even hope will prevail?
I think at this point in history, I hope that we can make good decisions and draw our ethics from a long past and not just sort of dive into these new technologies without really thinking them through, because the technologies that are being created now are going to really alter the way we interact and the way we think and the way the world works. And I just hope that we are able to use our intellects and practice a little bit of patience making these decisions.
Question from the audience. How has being a famous author changed life in New Hampshire for you?
Wow. You know,
besides getting called on pie plates.
I know,
stage.
Really. I used to be able to steal pie plates undetected. You know what? Strangely, it hasn't changed it a lot. I mean, the work certainly is the same. I still face a blank piece of paper every day. My characters don't care how many books I've sold. They still demand attention. And I still have a wonderful circle of friends who I think they're surprised probably to see me up there, like, oh, that's right, he writes books. So I don't think life has changed that much at all. I get to talk to smart people like you, and that's a pleasure, but otherwise it's about the same.
And you get asked advice. In this case, our 13-year-old daughter is very interested in writing stories, taking creative writing classes, and considering Phillips Exeter Academy for high school. What pointers would you give to her to grow her writing passion?
If you can go to Phillips Exeter, by all means, you should do it. You should go to whatever opportunities you have to educate yourselves, you should seize them, wherever they may be. And as far as writing, I suggest that you'll often hear writing teachers say, write what you know. And, a young child of 13 will probably come back and say, well, I don't know that much. I don't want to really write about my school or my homework. I would say write what you're dying to know. And this young person may say, well, I'm really interested in ballet. I said, okay, well, go and research everything you can about ballet. Go down to Boston. Go interview ballerinas. And write a book, educate yourself in such a way that you can write a book about it. And what happens when you do that is your passion for what you're learning comes through the writing and inspires your reader. So figure out what you're excited about and go learn it so you can write about it.
Advice to a young writer from Dan Brown, whose books have sold in the hundreds of millions. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR president is Betsy Gardella. Production and communication director is Margaret Talcott. The live sound and recording and mixing engineer, Ian Martin. Bob Lord and Dreadnought provide live music. Broadcast producer for NHPR is Ben Henry. Digital producer is Sarah Plord. The Music Hall production manager is Jonna Morris. Photos from the event are posted online at Clear Eye Photo. You can look at pictures and listen to more author interviews from this series at wordofmouthradio.org. Click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from NHPR.